Oikos presents 15 Seconds of Strength.
Here we go. Steve's got a trunk full of groceries and no one to help him.
Oh, that's tough, Jim. Looks like a 5-trip load at least.
He grabs the first bag, the second. Bob, it looks like he's trying to do it all one trip. He shimmies the door open, steps over the dog. Oh, and he stumbles.
Oh, right into the kitchen without missing a beat. Mm. Jim, now that's a man who eats his protein-packed Oikos.
With 15 grams of complete protein in each cup, Oikos Triple Zero can help build strength for every day. Oikos, stronger makes everything better.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
It's time to wake to sleep with Sleep Science Today, where we learn to sleep well with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today, where we talk about sleep issues affecting the everyday consumer. Today, we are going to be talking about sleep, and we're specifically going to be talking also about teenagers in sleep and children in sleep and regular sleep issues that the everyday person should be aware of. Our guest is Dr. Funke Afolabi-Brown. She is a sleep specialist, and Dr. Brown, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great, great. I do want to mention that Dr. Brown is author of the book Beyond Tired, and it's good information for anyone out there who's interested about sleep. And Dr. Brown, why don't we start off? Can you just tell us what would people find in your book? What can they look forward to?
So this book is really written for that parent who has a child that is struggling with sleep issues. And also for that parent who is struggling with sleep issues, especially as a mom. Mm-hmm. So really, what I noticed was across board of all the tons and tons of books that have been written about sleeping kids. But many times those books stop at, you know, the early life stages. So you have a book about sleep training in a baby, and you have dozens and dozens and dozens of those books. Or you have a book that's just really focused on insomnia. And so I wanted to create a book where parents know what is normal, they know what is abnormal, and they know what exactly to do to advocate for their child's sleep. But I also included in there a chapter specifically for moms, because moms do not prioritize their sleep. They put everybody else in ahead of them. And mm-hmm. So I know if I wrote a book only for moms, moms will probably not get it. They will probably get a book for their kids. And so I put an incredible treasure in that. And I'm so excited about that little trick. So this really then really expatiates on a lot of sleep disorders that women struggle with.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So that really is sort of the setting of the show here, because there's a lot of topics in there. And, you know, the things that I'm hearing that I want to make sure we get a chance to talk about, and we have plenty of time to do it. One is sleeping issues for children. Two is sleeping disorders for children, which would be different. Three would be sleeping issues and disorders for parents. So there's a lot in there. So why don't we start off? Maybe can you give us a little bit of a summary or background of what are the types of sleep issues that parents may have with young children, and compare and contrast that to sleep disorders that they should be looking for?
Yes. So we hear that term sleep issues, and not every sleep issue, whatever that means, may necessarily progress to become a sleep disorder. So I like how you put that distinction. So you might have a child, for instance, who maybe just likes his parent to fall asleep with them, right? So the child wants a parent in bed with them, and everybody's happy. It works well for them. It's not really causing any issues during the day. They're not waking up in the middle of the night. Well, this child is just really has a sleep crutch, right? And it may not necessarily mean that they have a sleep disorder. Compared to a child who falls apart if the parent leaves the room, who is crying, who wakes up multiple times at night, and also has daytime problems. Maybe they're very irritable during the day because they don't get enough sleep at night because of that sleep association. Or they have, or their parent is struggling because they've been up all night trying to put their child back to sleep. So in that situation, that's a sleep disorder, right? Mm-hmm. So sleep issues could be that, well, maybe you just have poor sleep hygiene and, you know, you're taking a bottle, you're giving your child a bottle to sleep, or, you know, they're watching TV in their bedroom, right? So those don't necessarily rise to the level of a sleep disorder that needs the consultation with an expert like myself or yourself, Andrew. Mm-hmm. But once you start to see the effect of that, either behaviorally or emotionally or psychologically or physically, then we really start to say, okay, there seems to be a sleep disorder here. And now there's a wide range of sleep disorders, right? It could be insomnia. It could be sleep apnea. It could be restless leg syndrome. This is when we start to say, okay, we need to get to the bottom of what is going on so that we can implement strategies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here's some questions based on just some things that I hear people talk about. So you mentioned the issue of like the parent sleeping in the child's bed or vice versa. Is there a recommendation out there based upon research that says whether A, is co-sleeping good or bad, or maybe we don't know, B, if a parent and child are sleeping in the same bed, is there an appropriate age that the child should or eventually should not? And C, if that is happening and the child is now used to it and continues on, how does the parent wean them off of it?
Yeah, great question. So the American Academy of Pediatrics discourages co-sleeping for children, especially under the age of one, especially for those under the age of 6 months, because there's a higher risk of sudden infant death syndrome, right? Especially if a parent is extremely tired. And so as a result of that, that's the recommendation. Now, room sharing is actually encouraged. So within that first year, especially if you're a parent who maybe you're nursing, having that opportunity to room share is beneficial in the sense that, you know, the child is, you can easily access your child nurse and put back to sleep. Mm-hmm. But there's the practicality, which is really where I bring a balance, because if only I don't want an 8-month-old in my bedroom, because they're as adorable as they are, they make all kinds of noises in the middle of the night where they may not necessarily be awake. But as a parent who's already hyper alert, you may notice that you become very sensitized to those, you know, sounds that they make, for instance. And so promoting independent sleep, I think, as early as possible is something that I always recommend to my patients. So, for instance, I would say within maybe by the time they're 6 months, by the time they're ready to get into their crib, you have the permission. Again, depending on what works for your family, what works in terms of your values, you have the permission to have them move to their own nursery or their room where you can use, you know, if you want to use a camera so you can hear them, a baby monitor, you could still access them. You could still know if they need help. And so then you yourself as a parent gets good sleep, because I think this is really where my mission has been, just really to help parents actually start to prioritize themselves. Because if you are exhausted all night long because you're waking up every time your little one startles, then you're going to wake up tired and you really will not be able to be the best version of yourself during the day.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So the first part there where you talked about the risk of sudden infant death syndrome, I know that I've heard stories where, you know, maybe you have a very, very young child in bed, and then the parent, like you said, is so tired that they don't even know, and they roll over and accidentally smother the baby, and not obviously not intentional. They don't even know it until after it's happened. Yeah. plus the fact I don't know if they can physically crush the baby or not. I'm not sure. I think babies are pretty pliable, but I'm not an expert in that.
And then,
you know, I can understand the having the baby there in the room in the initial part, just because you got to be getting up and doing the feedings and all the things that are required. But at some point, some parents decide to bring the child into bed with them. Now, that may be out of convenience, because then I don't have to get up and go to their room and check on them or whatever it may be. But is there a difference between children who were raised, you know, in the crib, and then they kind of got their own room and they were never in bed with parents, versus those who were raised in bed with the parents? Is there a difference that we see in terms of attachment, anxiety, any other types of issues?
No, not anything that we know based on literature that's available. And they've looked at this extensively. There's been like a lot of theories about the attachment theory and, you know, people coming to say, well, if you leave your child to sleep or cry it out or sleep train them, they're going to be damaged mentally and emotionally. And we just do not have the data to support that. So, in fact, the studies, and there are many studies that have been done that showed that a child that is able to sleep independently, and when parents teach their children to sleep independently, there's better emotional health for the child, and also better quality of life, better marriage, decreased stress, better mood, and all of that for the parents. So when you're helping your child sleep independently, it's not just for your child, actually, it's for you and for your family.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. So, all right. So let's talk about the situation where the parents did have the child sleep in their bed, and now they're at the point that they want to wean them off of it. And I'm thinking of some stories that I've heard. I'll just sort of create a conglomeration of the stories. Basically, let's say you have parents and they have three young children. And maybe it's like 1, 3, and 5 years old, something like that. And each of the children has been raised where they could sleep in the bed with mom and dad. And now the 5-year-old is turning 6. They're getting a little bit older. And the parents want to teach that person to start sleeping in their own bed. And they're having a really tough time getting the child to do that. And they say that even though we put the child in their own bed, they come in the middle of the night and they wake us up and they jump on the bed and they're crying and all these things. What do you do? How do you wean them off of that?
Yeah, one of the things we talk about is that sleep onset association. And that's a very common phenomenon, even in toddlers and also in school age children. Mm-hmm. And so, though the wake-up is in the middle of the night, the problematic wake-up is in the middle of the night, the child has not learned to fall asleep independently. And so at the end of the day, the focus is to teach the child to fall asleep independently at the beginning of the night. So when a child understands that sleep is an independent sport, so to speak, they feel comfortable and confident in falling asleep on their own. And that's a process. It's a process which we call sleep training. So you can either gradually fade yourself from that bedtime or do it abruptly, whatever works for you. Mm-hmm. Then when that child eventually recognizes, oh, when I fell asleep, I was alone and I was safe. And then when they wake up in the middle of the night, they're able to scan their environment, feel safe, and then fall back asleep. And this is a process. I usually will say, once about 2 or 3 weeks after your child has learned to sleep independently at night, at bedtime, most times the middle of the night wakings will improve.
Wow. Okay. All right. And is there a particular age that is recommended that if parents were having the child sleep with them, is there a recommended age that they should stop doing that?
No, it all depends on what the family wants. I think it's such a personal decision. I have families whose kids are 10 years old, 12 years old, and they still cannot sleep on their own. And I have families whose babies are 8 months old and they need help. So there's such a wide range.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we're at a natural stopping point here where we need to take a commercial break. So if you hang on, we will be back right after the commercial. We'll be continuing to talk with Dr. Brown, and we're going to talk about some teenage sleep issues. So we'll see you back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking about kids and teens and moms and sleep with families today with Dr. Brown. Thanks for helping us on that first segment, Doctor. What I'd like to do now is we were talking about kids and sleep issues and sleeping in the same bed and all, but how about this other one? We get the kid out of mom and dad's bed. They're sleeping in their own room now. And lo and behold, that ever-present sleep monster under the bed shows up. Can you help us shed a little bit of light on what's actually going on there?
Yeah, great question. So many times around age 4, sometimes 3.5, 2 and up, our kids just developmentally, their imagination just soars, right? During this stage, they're probably in maybe preschool or kindergarten. And they're starting to really develop this really vivid imagination, right? And this is when things might get out of control at night, where they not just have a little bit of anxiety about bedtime, they now start to have this, fears of monsters and the dark. And so it is very common, again, expected as part of development, but in some situations, it can actually impact sleep. Mm-hmm. So I see it a lot in children who maybe they've consumed a lot of graphic content. Even when we think about the current cartoons we watch, you would think, oh, there's cartoons are harmless. Even those sometimes can be graphic enough where it paints these scary pictures in the child's mind that they have such a hard time settling down to sleep.
Well, okay. So, if that starts to happen and parents are having to learn to figure out how to work through this, I've heard of things such as night lights, maybe monster spray, which is like a lavender spray the parents will spray in the room. Are there things out there that are worthwhile and helpful? Are there things that shouldn't be done? What's the best way for parents to address this?
Yeah, I mean, I think if it's a short-term issue, I would say start off by making sure that there's nothing else we're missing. Does your child have anxiety that's present during the day as well, and it has its manifestations at night? Because you don't want to miss that and just assume it's all just sleep-related. Another thing I would say is, have a conversation with them, maybe during the day, about what they're going through. I think this is something that we may feel like, oh, it's not that important, but actually can be very enlightening. Because by then you can start to see that maybe there are patterns, maybe there's something they're hearing in school or something they're watching, and you can hopefully help with intervening with that. When it comes to the bedtime, having a bedtime routine is so important, making sure that there's time for them to wind down, making sure that they have opportunities to bond with you and just really work on being present. Sometimes even little children, you can teach them mindfulness-based practices to help them. And then, in some instances, we'll do, if you have a child who just gets really scared about monsters, you can. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with getting a spray bottle and putting some water, maybe a little bit of lavender, and you just kind of spray it. It smells nice. It's calming. You can have the child just spray it as part of their routine as well. And I think that's great. When it comes to a night light, I think it's okay, again, on the short term. What you do want to avoid is the light being, you know, them seeing the light directly. So if you're going to have a nightlight, you probably want to put it closer to the head of the bed where they're not seeing that directly. And as long as it's not too bright, it is completely fine. And then some other kids actually have worries. They're worried, they're stressed out, a burglar is going to come in or something happened in school. You can actually create worry time for your child during the day. So maybe sometime after school, you know, they could draw what their worries are. They could write what their worries are. And you can have a healthy conversation with them about it.
Wow, that's great. So I guess you could do that same worry exercise with the monster itself, as opposed to other worries, you know, in general.
Any type of worries, exactly. Any type of worries, yeah.
Fantastic. Wow, okay. Okay, well, let's move on a little bit in terms of, we've talked about children, and children eventually grow up and they turn into teenagers. They hit that magic mark of 13 through 19. We know that they change, their personalities change and things over that time. What type of sleep issues come up for teenagers that you've seen?
Yeah, quite a number of sleep issues come up with teenagers. So starting from the fact that they have a delay in their circadian rhythm, what this does is that it makes it such that they have a harder time falling asleep compared to typical. So they may initially be able to fall asleep at 9 p.m. and then your child goes through puberty and, you know, it's 11 p.m. and they're still not sleeping. And so these are all physiologic, except if they now have to wake up very early to go to school, we can imagine that they eventually will be short on sleep and have insufficient sleep. And then another thing that could happen is the fact that they might have a hard time falling asleep, so insomnia. And that's because of a multiple number of reasons, right? They're going to bed at a time that's too early compared to their circadian time. It might be, you know, anxiety, worries about school pressure and things like that. So I think it's important to figure out what's going on to be able to determine the intervention. And then they also have, you know, restless leg syndrome, sleep apnea, narcolepsy as well, as other disorders that they might have. So it's really important to dig deep. I've had children who are excessively sleepy during the day. They have a hard time waking up to get to school. They're diagnosed with depression and ADHD. And it turns out that they have narcolepsy. So this, while we might think, oh yeah, the most common reason why teenagers are not getting enough sleep is because they have, you know, they have insufficient sleep. Among those children, you might also have narcolepsy.
Wow. That's a lot to think about. And I'm just thinking to myself, so if you are, if a parent is listening to this show and they have a teen, what types of things can or should they look for to try and know if, A, does my teen have narcolepsy? B, do they have sleep apnea? Like, how would someone know to even check on a sleep disorder for a teen?
Yeah, so a few things that you might want to do. I think if you, first of all, realize that the child is having a hard time waking up in the morning, despite getting enough sleep. And the way I usually will say it is, you know, for instance, maybe on the weekend they sleep in, how are they? And they say, well, even if they sleep 14 hours, they are still tired. Mm-hmm. That's a red flag that something else is going on that we don't know about. They have snoring, restless sleep. Those are all clues of sleep disordered breathing. So those are situations where you probably need them to be evaluated. And then also, if you're noticing that, again, they seem like they're getting enough sleep and they're extremely sleepy during the day. They can hardly sit upright, exhausted all the time. You really want to check for what we call hypersomnia or narcolepsy.
Okay. And is there any, you know, based on the science, is there any difference that we could expect between teenage boys and teenage girls in terms of sleep disorders?
So quite. I would say we just don't have enough of that research. Post-puberty, before pre-puberty and during puberty, the prevalence, meaning the likelihood of having sleep apnea, is about the same in boys and girls. And then after puberty, and in young adults, we start to see a higher prevalence of sleep disordered breathing in boys compared to girls. So we do have that. But the other sleep disorders, I'm not sure that we've studied that enough to answer that question.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then you mentioned earlier that as they become teens, that their circadian rhythm kind of changes. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? So when I think of circadian rhythm, I think of, you know, the sun goes down, it gets dark outside, I get sleepy, the sun comes up, I wake up, and that's my circadian rhythm. So if that's the case, the sun doesn't change its time, what happens to a teenager that their rhythm changes?
Yeah, so the sun doesn't change its time, but the brain response to those changes is a little bit delayed. So our circadian rhythm follows a cycle, a 24-hour cycle, right? And most times it is in sync with the sun. But those internal rhythms are just slightly pushed back, so a little bit later in teenagers. And so what that means is they still will get the, the cues from the sun. Mm-hmm. But the way that, for instance, melatonin secretion is mounted in them, it's just pushed back. So everything is a little bit later, at least for most teenagers. And so that's what contributes to this asynchrony, right? So they are feeling sleepy in the morning, early hours on the morning, when everybody else is expected to be waking up. So those are things that you see that makes it different and unique about a teenager.
Right. And that plays right into a big issue today, which is if the teen is naturally going to bed later, naturally waking later, and naturally sleeping longer, right, at that age, then at the same time, they're in junior high and high school that starts really early. So we're disrupting their sleep pattern to force them to wake up and get to school. And then we expect them to be able to concentrate and learn things. And I know there's a movement out there in several states to delay the school start times. But then you get into, well, there's rush hour traffic and parents have to get to work and all these things. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's hard, and there's been a lot of conversation about it. I think there's been a lot of fears, but what I would say is there's also been a lot of studies that have shown that with delaying school start times, we actually can guarantee success in our teenagers. They become more productive citizens in the world eventually. They're more likely to graduate. There's a less likelihood of them getting involved in road traffic accidents. There's decrease in suicidality and other mental health issues. So when we look at all those benefits, and yes, maybe a little bit of discomfort around how structurally things need to change, I would beg that we look err on the side of supporting our teenagers' health. Mm-hmm. It's not just their physical health, it's their mental health, their emotional health, right? And their future. And so there's so many studies that have been done that show this, that as children, our teenagers go to bed later. I'm sorry, as they get able to wake up later because of delayed school start times, they get enough sleep. So they get more sleep. They're better aligned with their circadian rhythm. Their mood improves. The decision making and reflexes improve. So all these things are beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay. So then one last question about teens and sleep before we take our next break here. And that is, and you know, I tend to think of it as teenage boys, but it may also be teenage girls. I honestly don't know. But I typically think of the teenage boy late at night, sitting in front of their computer, playing video games, engrossed in what they're doing, very excited about what's happening. The night's getting later and later and later, and they're still in their game. Any advice for parents and or teens, in case they're listening to this together, what should people do related to video games?
Yeah, I would say I don't necessarily recommend that we, I think having conversations with them is important, because I feel like a lot of times our teenagers feel threatened that we just want to take devices away from them. And unfortunately, the world we live in now, that's one of the major ways by which a lot of our teens connect. So how do we bridge the gap where we're empowering them to do their duties, go to school, do homework, all of that, without resorting to taking away what, you know, really gives them joy and pleasure? Mm-hmm. So I think this is where the balance is, and this is where conversation comes in. And this is where coming in from a place of empathy to say, yes, I know this is meaningful for you, but here are some expectations. And, you know, as long as we're able to meet those expectations, and also the why behind it. So if they're playing games till very late, they're more likely to, wake up later, maybe miss some school or be very tired. And so how does that impact them long term? And so when we have those conversations with them, they can kind of see the why, and they're more likely to, you know, follow up or follow through.
Great, great. Well, thank you for that. And it is now time for us to take our second commercial break here. But we will be right back on Sleep Science Today with Dr. Brown, and we're going to talk more about parents and kids and sleep. Stay tuned.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Welcome back to Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking with Dr. Brown about children and teens and parents and sleep. So, Dr. Brown, we've covered kids, we've covered teens. Now, the most important part, I think, for the parents that are probably the ones listening to this show, the parents. What types of issues do parents typically have when they're dealing with their own sleep as well as their kids' sleep?
Yeah, there's a wide number of issues. I would say insufficient sleep or sleep deprivation is one big one. There's hardly a child who has sleep issues that doesn't have a parent that has sleep issues. And most times, in fact, sometimes the child is okay. The parent is just the one that's struggling. Hmm. And many times it's really, really direct a relationship, right? If a child wakes up and has a hard time falling asleep, they're not just going to lay in bed and stay still. They're going to come for that parent to say, hey, I need help. So that's one big one. And then I would say a lot of times also, there's some self-imposed sleep deprivation that we bring on ourselves. So doom scrolling on social media, spending time just watching TV or binge watching TV, eating very late at night, doing work very late in the day. Those are all things that can make it really, really hard for us to sleep as parents. Mm-hmm. And then we have insomnia, where, you know, your mind is racing, you have a hard time falling asleep, and that just is what keeps you awake. And at the end of the day, can potentially become very chronic very quickly.
Right.
And then finally, we have sleep apnea. You know, many parents, you know, adults have sleep apnea. It's often underdiagnosed. So that might also be an issue that parents are struggling with.
Mm-hmm. Well, you said something there that raised a question in my mind. So if you have a person who has insomnia, so they're having trouble sleeping or they're having trouble staying asleep, right? And then you talk with them about their insomnia and they say, well, what happens is in the middle of the night, my kid gets out of bed and comes and crawls into my bed and wakes me up and so on and so forth. So then the question becomes, Is there insomnia? Is there just something with the kid? Is there both going on? Do you ever deal with that?
Oh, yes, all the time. So that's that's actually something that's pretty common with a lot of parents. You don't even know. It's so entangled. It may have started off with the child not sleeping well. And then over time, you start to see that, even though the child is now actually their sleep issues are better, now the parent is left with insomnia. And, you know, this goes back to that, the 3P. We talk about the 3P model of insomnia, where there's predisposing factors, there's precipitating factors, and there's perpetuating factors. So let me give you an example of that. You know, that mom, for instance, who went through maybe a challenging pregnancy, had the child, maybe in between lost her job. So those are all precipitating factors, right? Okay. Maybe now the child is growing and is now not sleeping, right? Waking up multiple times. And so that becomes something that's now, again, further precipitates her own sleep issues. But on the background, she had some predisposing factors. She's a little worried. She's a little bit of a type A. She's a little, you know, there's some family history of insomnia. So that really sets her up in terms of the predisposing factors. And then the third P is what we call those perpetuating factors. So now she's in this spiral where her mind is telling her she can't do it alone. She needs a sleep aid. The child is already sleeping well, but she's still reliant on so many things to be able to sleep well. So it's oftentimes hard to figure out like which started first, but the end result is very similar, which is that hard time sleeping.
Right. Wow. So that leads me into sort of another area here, which is two things that I think are important that we cover. One is basic sleep hygiene, both for parents and for kids. So I'd be curious for your comments on that. And then secondly, after that, I'm curious about the use of any sort of over-the-counter sleep aids or anything else for parents and or for children. So could you comment first on the sleep hygiene issues?
Yes. So I use this acronym. I call it the Create Restful Sleep Habits. And I like that because it is evidence-based and it works for both the child as well as the parent. So CREATE is an acronym. So C-R-E-A-T. So C stands for consistency. So having a consistent sleep time and wake up time is important for both the child and the parent. R is the routine. So, wind down exercises that are leading you to in the direction of the bedroom is helpful for the child as well as the parent. Then A stands for assign the bed for sleep and sleep in bed. And this is important because many times, especially parents, we're bringing the phone into bed with us. We're bringing all sorts of things. So it creates the wrong association. So you want to really train your brain to expect sleep. E, E is the environment. So you want to optimize that environment, making sure that you have a room that is cool, that is dark, and it's noise free. Because all those things can disrupt sleep quality. And again, it's for both the child and the parent. And then T is technology. So getting the devices out of the bedroom about 30 to 60 minutes before bed is a healthy option. And again, both for the child and also for the parent, especially. And then the last E is eliminate. So eating heavy meals or caffeine or alcohol, you know, definitely these are sleep disruptors. So you have to kind of take a look at what are healthy options that I can look for that can help improve my sleep.
That last one is a tricky one because I was just talking with a high school student just yesterday about sleep. And the issue was, you know, well, we have all these tests and things that we have to study for, and we have to, you know, stay up late so that we can get enough study time in because the tests are really important. And so all of my friends, they rely upon these high caffeine energy drinks because they want to stay up and cram in the exam. And I said, you know, you get much better retention and much better, you know, results if you actually sleep where your brain can process the information But how do you convince a teen that these high energy drinks are not the best thing to help them when it comes to studying and preparing?
Yeah, no, it's I think it's really helping them realize that there are alternatives. And sometimes what I have them do, because I work with a lot of teens in my program, is let's do an experiment. Let's do this week. Let's spend some time really comparing. Compare drinking a cup of an energy drink with a 15-minute nap. Mm-hmm. And let me know how you feel. You know, right then and there, they can tell, oh my gosh, I feel a lot more alert from a 15-minute nap. So that's usually what we try to do. And then just helping, I think many times kids do not understand the why. And that's why they just automatically assume that what you're telling them to do is not going to work. And so helping them understand why would we say caffeine, you know, very high energy drink or high caffeinated energy drink is not ideal. And helping them really understand that why is something that's going to be very important in getting them on your side. And it may take some time, it may take a few conversations, but they all want to feel better. And so when you create this dialogue where they're seeing and understanding why, it does make a whole world of difference.
Mm-hmm. I like that sort of comparison test of a 15-minute nap versus the drink, because I think that probably would speak, you know, loads just in and of itself. So thank you for that tip. So that then brings us into this category of, you know, there are so many different prescription sleep meds, over-the-counter sleep aids. There's so many things out there today. And so many patients, at least that I work with, they come to me, they have insomnia, they've been taking prescription sleep meds, and they say, I want to get off of all these meds. And I'm like, great, because I think it's great to be off the meds, you know, if you can do it. And so we work to help them get off the meds. And most of the time, we're very successful with that. But it concerns me when you have teens or preteens who are using either sleep meds or a lot of times, I guess, over-the-counter things, because in my opinion, based upon the research and things that I've read, they can be sort of interfering with their natural systems. So in other words, if they're taking a bunch of melatonin, then their body doesn't need to produce as much melatonin, and then they're setting themselves up for more sleep problems down the road. So I'm curious, what are your opinions on that? Do you have any advice? Do you have any things to share?
Yeah, I mean, I think supplements have just been so widely publicized that one way or the other, most people are using it. But I would say for those who have actual sleep disorders, most times the supplements are not effective. Mm-hmm. So dealing with the root cause is important. So if you have a child with insomnia, we would recommend cognitive behavioral therapy. Many times the reason why they feel they need to take supplements is because they don't have any sleep confidence. That's it. They're not confident in their body's ability to fall asleep. So through cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, even if we have to modify it for our teenagers, you're able to help them reestablish sleep confidence, and then we can start to back off on the supplements. Mm-hmm. I prefer, if I'm told to pick, I would absolutely prefer supplements over actual sleep aids or sleep medications, right? Any day, anytime. Mm-hmm. But it would still be the same approach, really just helping them reestablish their sleep confidence.
Right, right. And I just want to point out, because I have patients who ask this question a lot. So when we talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, there's a lot of different therapies out there. And what Dr. Brown is talking about is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, which is sort of the gold standard used for insomnia. And it is a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, but it is different from when someone goes to their therapist and they say, oh, my therapist is doing CBT with me. They're doing talk therapy over things. That's different. So cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia is a very specific type of process designed for insomnia issues. So,
yes, CBTI, definitely. Thank you for highlighting that difference. Because, yes, I've had people come and they say, oh, I've done CBT, and it's not CBTI, which is the insomnia piece of it. So it's entirely different.
Right, right. Well, Dr. Brown, I want to thank you for your time, because we've reached the end of our time here. I do want to remind the audience that you are author of the book Beyond Tired. Is that something they can get on Amazon?
Yes, absolutely. So if you put in Beyond Tired on Amazon, Beyond Tired book, it'll come up. And I would encourage folks to read it. It's very helpful. Schools, there's also a chapter in there for schools. I think it's a pretty comprehensive guide, especially because there's so much unknown in the world of pediatric sleep that this book really tackles a lot of questions that many people have.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for taking the time to write that book and make it available to the public. And thank you for taking time out of your day to join us on this show. It really is helpful to those who are trying to figure out how to deal with sleep issues. So, all right. So we are finishing up this episode of Sleep Science Today. If you are interested in more episodes, visit us at www.sleepsciencetoday.com. We have this show. It will be up on YouTube, so you can actually see Dr. Brown, or it's also on podcasts, so you can hear the show. So however you want to listen to it, we don't care, as long as you get the information and help yourself and sign up for our mailing list, and we'll get you out some special information. So thank you for joining us in Sleep Science Today. We look forward to seeing you on our next episode. Thank you, Dr. Brown.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Sleep Science Today and learning how to sleep better with your host, Andrew Kolsky, on UK Health Radio. For more information on how you can achieve better sleep, go to sleepsciencetoday.com. Remember, Sleep Science Today and sleep better tonight.